A new equation for switching on outcomes is here from PwC. It's human-led and tech-powered. It's PwC with Oracle, SAP, Salesforce, and Workday. It's PwC with Microsoft, AWS, and Google. Simplify your systems and amplify your results. Switch on outcomes with PwC and their alliances. Learn more at pwc.com.
Hey, hotcakes, welcome to Hot Take, the podcast where we talk about the climate crisis and all the ways we're talking and not talking about it. I'm Amy Westervelt.
And I'm Mariana Yves Hegler. And this episode, we're going to talk about some of the parts of the climate crisis that we don't talk about that much, at least not here. It's kind of like the hidden cost of climate change. You know, the extreme weather that's happening in the global south and how that's leading to this huge migration crisis and how we're not really talking about it that way. And the huge toll that it takes on environmental activists in the global south and how that sort of apathy that we in the West, in particular the United States, have shown to the rest of the world, how it's kind of turning on us now and all that's at stake in this election. And we're sitting down with a perfect guest for this conversation.
That's right. We got to talk to Rachel Ramirez this week. She is a writer for Grist. Her beat is environmental justice. And she grew up in the Marianas Islands and talked to us.
And she's Filipina.
Right. So she talked to us about, you know, what it was like to live through storms there that weren't getting coverage and what it was like to be here when Superstorm U2 hit and, you know, she wasn't able to get news coverage about it or to reach her family, all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, she's got a bird's eye view.
It's a handful of countries that get the coverage. And it's the vast majority of the world that just gets ignored.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, this was a really interesting and important conversation I felt like we should have before the election. This is our last episode before the election. And we'll getting back together just to vent and talk through whatever happens on November 4th, which is my birthday. So send me chocolate.
It's like it's 7 days away and it feels like a freaking parallel universe that we can't
see.
It does.
Like, I can't imagine the world afterwards. So,
that'll be
interesting. So if you want links to the articles that we discuss in the show, make sure that you sign up for our newsletter.
That's right.
We'll have some more information about how to do that at the end of this episode and in the show notes. And also make sure that you go and leave us a rating or review on iTunes. Again, we have a different system for people to leave negative feedback. We'll talk more about that at the end of the show as well.
And
with that,
it's time to talk about climate. Hi, Rachel. Thanks for doing this. We appreciate you joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So, first things first, question we ask everybody, how did you get into journalism and specifically into climate journalism?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long story, but I actually got into journalism because of a significant climate disaster that happened in my hometown. So for those who don't know, I was born and raised in Saipan, Northern Mariana Islands. It's a U.S. territory just north of Guam. And if you don't know where Guam is, I guess just pull up a Google Maps. But I guess the summer of 2015, I was an incoming sophomore. I went to the University of Portland, and that summer I visited my hometown and went back home, visited my family, my friends, and then back to Portland because I was starting college again, second year of college. And a couple of days after I came back, I think 3 days after I came back, a super typhoon was literally barreling down the Marianas, and it was Super Typhoon Sutilore. It was a Category 5, and it was really destructive. And my parents call me every day, And I guess when the power went off in Saipan or across the island, I was really worried, and I refreshing my Facebook feed, my Twitter feed, mm-hmm. all my social media, trying to get updates. And, my mom and my dad are there, my sister's there, my friends were there, but I wasn't getting the updates that I needed. And I just left, mm-hmm. and I was in Portland, and I think my first sort of instinct when something like this happens is to write and to, after writing, I guess, multiple Facebook statuses of and sharing things of what's happening. And, there was a lack of coverage too of what's happening. Mm-hmm. Not even lack, I guess there was zero besides newspapers in Guam. So I wrote this, super amateur, I guess, article. CNN had this iReport submission. I don't know if you both remember that, but I don't think they have it anymore. But you sort of submit an article and you get this URL that you can share in your social media. But it's not published. It's kind of like a citizen journalism tip. Submission type thing. But I did that, and then I got the URL, shared it on Facebook, and then once the power went back on in the islands, it was widely shared. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, I think this is what I wanted to do.
Have you seen things in the way that it's discussed that you would change, or that you want to kind of focus on trying to change yourself?
Yeah. So I've been invited to talk to grad students at NYU and CUNY in the last couple of weeks. And mm-hmm. one thing that I kept telling them is that, if you're going to be a climate journalist, you have to step outside of, the bubble and remember that climate justice or climate change really intersects with a plethora of issues such as, housing justice, economic justice, racial justice, immigration, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I guess, this is more for journalists. And, we all know in our circle, we know this. And my partner probably thinks I'm a broken record after hearing this a few times. But, I could not emphasize it enough, is that, if you don't think a news story is a climate story, I think, again, and that's something that I told them a lot. And, if you don't think COVID mm-hmm. is a climate story, think again. If you don't think immigration is a climate story, think again.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing that I would change in the way we discuss climate. I mean, as climate journalist, in the work that we do in our space, we know this, but I think in the overall sort of climate discourse and discussion, I feel like that's something that mm-hmm. a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah.
It's interesting, right? Because we've turned COVID into an everything story, right? Like, you wouldn't write about this year's baseball season without talking about how it intersects with COVID. And you shouldn't write about it without talking about how it intersects with climate either, right? Like, it's hotter out there. And on that note, are there any interesting themes that you've noticed? I feel like the climate conversation has changed dramatically in the past 2 years, and it's changing just all the time. So are there any encouraging in particular themes that you've noticed in the way that we're talking about climate change now?
Yeah, I definitely think environmental justice is coming into the spotlight more now, mm-hmm. especially in the larger picture. Again, I think for us, it's something, we've sort of been writing and talking about for a long time and for a while now. But I think for other folks outside of climate Twitter or the climate space, I feel like, they think that environmental justice is just about, and I think I tweeted this actually, vulnerable communities getting hit the hardest from storms and wildfires. But, we know that it's bigger than that. It's about the military poisoning the Pacific. It's about formerly redlined communities suffering the most from extreme heat. It's, deeper than that. And I think now the narrative has shifted to, it's Black and brown communities intentionally and disproportionately located next to polluting infrastructure, the fossil fuel industry. And we saw that come up for the first time, at least in my lifetime, on the debate stage last week when Kristen Welker asked the candidates about that very question. And, I remember jumping on my couch and screaming when I heard that. But, it's more interesting because it's why now, right? When environmental justice has been a term and an issue around that's been around for decades, since like right. the 70s. So yeah, I think, I know it's my beat, but like, I really do think that environmental justice is a theme that's sort of emerging now.
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't the first time in your lifetime. That was the first time ever. Before this election cycle, the discussion of climate change in any presidential or vice presidential forum was total 10 minutes.
Well, and certainly no one ever asked about environmental justice. Definitely.
Absolutely not.
I mean,
something so powerful that it's a woman of color who asked it too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she left a lot to be desired in terms of pushing back on a lot of the nonsense, though.
Do you mean the "I'm the least racist person in this room" comment, Mary?
I mean that. I mean so much shit, Amy. So much shit.
I know.
So
yeah, but no, it was cool that she in particular asked that question, and that, you know, I mean, I'm sure it's like the first time several people watching thought about that,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, but yeah, I don't know why it's emerging now and not, you know, like 15, 20, 30 years ago.
I think the discussion, I feel like, started too when during the No Dapple protest, but then mm-hmm. it kind of dwindled down again, and then the youth climate movement came up, and then and then now it's coming up again while, you know, as the country.
That's true.
This racial reckoning.
Yeah, that's true. And I do think the youth climate movement is way, way better at just like coming at it from an EJ lens from the jump. Like they didn't have to be told that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what are you reading these days? Do you, are there particular newsletters that you read? We know you have one too. Or particular writers that you follow, or a book that you read recently
or
that
outlets.
You think is great on climate?
I mean, you know, just this week, just yesterday, I feel like there was a bunch of environmental stories that were published and really great investigation pieces.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, read both of you and listen. But I think there's a lot of journalists, and I don't think I can list all of them. And, you know, I tweeted a bunch of articles yesterday as well. But right now and recently, I would, you know, I recommend reading, and I wrote about this, the book Poisoning the Pacific, which just came out this month. And I wrote about it in The Guardian, and it basically explores and highlights how the U.S. military covered up years of contamination and this environmental destruction in the Pacific of indigenous lands and across the Marianas and Marshall Islands and Hawaii and Okinawa and Japan, and just, you know, just burying barrels of toxic chemicals and just, you know, all these things that's literally poisoning the Pacific. And that's a title. So yeah, I read that and I was just shocked, and I really highly recommend people read that. And it's Poisoning the Pacific by John Mitchell. And then right now I actually have a book with me called, and I've been referencing it in some of my stories, called Disposable City by Mario Alejandro Ariza. I'm probably butchering his name, I'm sorry, but it's about Miami's future on the shores of climate catastrophe. So I guess those are the two books that I've been reading, kind of going back to.
I love it. Nobody ever gives us book recommendations, so that is awesome.
I know. I love that. Yes. Totally.
I started this year tracking the books that I read. So I log it down in my Goodreads. And so I'm on track to do like 30 books, hopefully, by the end of the year.
That's awesome. Writing a lot. Sounds like it's kind of like your safe place, as it is for me and Amy. So this lightning round is about writing. So she'd be like right up your alley. Rachel, what do you call a writer who doesn't follow the rules of sentence structure?
Oh my God. A journalist. I don't know.
A rebel without a clause. You get some, don't worry. What did the writer who became a baker become known for?
Jeez. I have no idea. I have no smart answer.
You can also ask Amy for help because she should know these two.
God, I'm terrible at these. Mm-hmm. Mary loves to tell people to ask me for help because I'm even worse at them than everybody else.
Kind of.
Mary did this. This was Mary's idea.
Yeah.
This is
Mary's idea. Yeah. This is what we call the Punderdome.
Can you repeat the question, Mary?
What did the writer who became a baker become known for? Okay. Oh. It's her synonym roles.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. I never would have gotten that.
Rachel, the real reason we want to have you on the show is because we wanted to talk about the parts of the climate crisis that we often don't talk about here in the United States, because they don't happen here. They happen below the equator generally. And I wanted to start off by having you read from a piece that you wrote last year in Grist.
A year ago, this island was hit with the worst U.S. storm since 1935. What happened next? Super Typhoon Yutu made history as the worst storm to hit United States soil since 1935. The Category 5 storm wreaked havoc on the islands of Saipan and Tinian, which are part of the U.S. Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. The storm left thousands of residents without homes. For weeks, fallen power poles and palm trees blocked main roads, while tin roofing and debris blanketed the ground. Saipan International Airport canceled all flights for about a month. South Korea deployed military jets to rescue tourists trapped on the decimated island. Hurricane Maria made headlines 2 years ago when it pummeled Puerto Rico, another U.S. territory, but many mainland Americans didn't hear much about Super Typhoon Yutu. That's not only because of the scarce media attention, but also because the islands are largely missing from U.S. history textbooks. Now a year has gone by since Yutu battered the Northern Marianas, and residents are still reeling, waiting for government funding, watching warily as another storm season passes, and wondering when things will get back to normal.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And
yeah, you know, we talked about this a little bit, about just how little coverage there was of this storm when it happened, but I don't think I even realized that the airport was shut down for a month. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's happening there? What's happening there now? How's it? Because I know, like, with Maria, too, it's still, you know, they're waiting for things. And
yeah, I mean, COVID also compounded with the lack of tourists and driving the economy. So the island is also suffering from that.
Yeah.
So I visited in 2019, last year, summer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure this is still true today, but there are still sort of brown refugee like tents from FEMA.
Right.
Those tents still exist today because a lot of the homes are still, you know, really destroyed. So I think most people are still have the tents, but I think a lot of people have also moved on to, I guess, apartments or other homes. And I know a lot of people have also moved on to the mainland. And, you know, now that even personally, my sister is in college in California, my parents are sort of tired of dealing with sort of the economy and also the storms that keep battering the island. And my parents are planning to move to the mainland soon. Possibly next year. It was supposed to be this year, but the pandemic happened. So it's had an impact, and a lot of people's lives changed since then.
Right. It's really sad how little coverage a storm like this got. And it's also that it won't be the last. It hasn't been the last. And every single, and like the trauma that comes from something like that, which is another thing that I really appreciated about your article. It's a year after it actually happened. And so you get to see what the scars look like a year later. And it's just something that people don't, people in the United States on the mainland are not really thinking about, and how the lack of coverage can lead to a lack of response, a lack of donations, a lack of just like even awareness that this happened.
Yeah. So there's actually an article that also was published. I think it was for, it was last month or this month in Harper's Magazine. Where the article spotlights Super Typhoon Yutsu in Saipan. The writer, her name I think was Sierra Murdoch, and she is not from Saipan whatsoever, but she writes a lot about indigenous communities, and I think she spent some time in Saipan getting to know the community, and I think she really did a great job of sort of telling their stories in a very, you know, narrative and visceral way. And essentially explores what, you know, when is it time to abandon a place to climate change? And I don't know, that story, you know, gave me chills because a lot of people, she spotlighted this family who, you know, after waiting for, I guess, a month for FEMA to inspect their homes because it was totally like flattened and destroyed by Yutsu, they sort of this ultimately decided to, you know, uproot their lives and move to Seattle where some of their relatives are. And so that idea of like starting from scratch again after like leaving their life behind in Saipan was, you know, really heartbreaking. And I don't know, I just thought that article really, you know, and really touched on the feelings of, I don't know, it was just emotional for me. And it was,
Yeah, that makes me really happy to hear that they published that, because the last time we read anything in Harper's, it was when they published that letter about cancel culture. And and Amy and I went through their archive to be like, when's the last time they did a climate story? And it was freaking December. So I'm thrilled to see them turn their attention back to that. It's also, I saw you tweet recently that, you know, you just voted, and you talked about like all of the people in, you know, the global South who may or may not get to vote. I mean, Mariana Islands, they do get to vote, but they don't get, I don't think they get electoral college representation, do they?
I talked about how in the U.S. territories, which is the Northern Mariana Islands, Guam, U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, and American Samoa, who can't vote. So the U.S. Census Bureau estimates that they have, that's about 4 million Americans, because anyone born in those islands are U.S. citizens, but, you know, they lack the constitutional right to vote. And the messed up part is that they can serve in the military. And so, you know, having, you know, they can serve in the military, serve for their country, but they can't even vote for their commander in chief, which is, I guess, insane to me. And, you know, I think a lot of people sort of ask, like, and there's this sort of movement to, and it's also an environmental justice movement to demilitarize the Marianas, and especially in Guam. And sort of gaining that independent status. But a lot of people sort of ask, like, if Saipan or the Marianas or Guam were its own, you know, independent country, would it have been able to finance its own recovery? But, you know, the hard truth is that I don't think it would have financed its own recovery without FEMA assistance. I guess that's the hard truth. And, you know, we have right now a president and an administration that's currently rolling back environmental regulations that are supposed to be addressing climate change that's facing these U.S. territories and small island nations. But yeah, it's hard. And it's you know, on top of that, the military is expanding in those islands as well. And they're sort of part of the problem when it comes to releasing greenhouse gas emissions and exacerbating climate change.
Yeah. So another disaster I wanted to shine a light on that really drove me crazy was Cyclone Amphan, which battered Bangladesh and India, and was just an extraordinarily strong and dangerous storm in a place that was the Sundarbans, which are rapidly, rapidly sinking in India. If you've read Amitav Ghosh's Gun Island novel, it's all about climate change, is set there. So there was this piece that came out shortly after the storm called Cyclone Amphan, Victims Feel Abandoned by the International Community. It's published in a German outlet. This past May. So the journalist basically just quoted this 19-year-old student who goes by SM Shaheen Alam. And he says, "Cyclones don't scare me anymore. What scares me is that we're dying slowly because of climate change. All our farmlands and shrimp enclosures have been submerged once again. It means we won't be able to cultivate anything in the coming months. We have to rely on support from non-governmental organizations. Sometimes I feel that the international community has also abandoned us. They have left us to die slowly. The West is largely responsible for global warming, which has resulted in higher sea levels. We are the ones who have to suffer because of it. Still, we don't see any international initiative for our protection."
Yeah. True. I kind of am surprised that the conversation around climate reparations hasn't reemerged. Like, this is something that came up when the guy who held the first underwater
cabinet
meeting in the Maldives, like, he was a big proponent of that. Mm-hmm. So was Evo Morales in Bolivia. This was, you know, like a thing at the Copenhagen talks.
Yeah, even the Copenhagen UN conference that was like a predecessor to the Paris Agreement.
2009. Anyway, I feel like there was a big kind of, there's a lot of momentum then around that idea, and it just sort of like petered out.
Yeah. I have theories. It
seems well past time for that to come back.
Yeah. But the thing you notice that the people that you named as being like really strong proponents of reparations,
they've all been ousted.
Yeah. They've been deposed. So there was this wave of authoritarianism that kind of took their place. The guy in the Maldives was like replaced by a military coup that was like, you don't need climate action. You need development. And so then you, and it's just happening all over the place. It would make sense for it to come back, but authoritarianism seems to be taking its place instead. And it's just it's terrifying, honestly. And all of this is turning into this big wave of climate migration that, up until super recently, people weren't even calling it climate migration.
I know. Well, and that really plays into all the authoritarianism too, right? It's this crazy rise of anti-immigration sentiment and eco-fascism and all of that.
And something that you were talking about, Rachel, was about Indonesia moving its capital.
It was, I guess, summer of 2019 when the Indonesian president, Joko Widodo, I just searched it up, announced that, you know, the capital city will be relocated to the island of Borneo instead of Jakarta. I don't think he explicitly acknowledged that it was because of the climate crisis, but it is because of, you know, it is sinking and people have been calling it a sinking city, and also due to its overpopulation and industrial activity and sort of things like that, and just overall bad air quality and water pollution that's been, plaguing the city's residents. It's some form of managed retreat that we're seeing.
Yeah, that's interesting though too, because I do feel like the whole managed retreat thing just terrifies me, because I feel like it's not really being planned out. And to define that term, it's sort of, you know, just moving people out of harm's way when we know that, you know, where they're living is going to be inundated with water in the next few years. Or like there's been some talk about, you know, at what point do we stop rebuilding some of these areas in California that keep getting burned down?
Yeah. You know?
But the problem is, I mean, it's so much a microcosm of the broader climate conversation, right? Where it's like, we don't want to deal with that and plan for it. So we're just going to wait until it's like a crisis situation and then have people like running from their homes.
Yeah. <know?
laughs> Yeah.
It's like humans aren't infrastructure, and we have, you know, memories that are built into the community and the neighborhood.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing is it's like, okay, well, if it's not, well, A, who should be in charge of that? Who is in charge of it? Who's making the decisions about like where people should move? How does that get funded? How is it just? There's so many unanswered questions about it. And I just, I don't have a lot of faith in those questions being answered well or equitably.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That equitable measure is super important. And I think, you know, we're seeing, and I mentioned this, I think, earlier, where I'm writing the story on home buyout programs that's happening, you know, that happens in Louisiana and Texas. Mm-hmm. And we're also seeing it happening in New York and Staten Island, of how communities are getting uprooted and they're getting paid property values, pre-storm property values, and sort of the government is buying them out to demolish their homes and sort of moving them into higher ground. And that's a form of managed retreat that's better for the government financially, because if, you know, if you keep, I guess, if without the home buyout programs, I think the home buyout programs is meant to be sort of economically feasible than having to repay them with FEMA assistance over and over again each year whenever another hurricane comes along. I think that's something that most governments of coastal cities are looking into now in the U.S., but it's a program that's being studied continuously.
Spend an average of 90% of their time indoors, which is bad news because according to the EPA, indoor air could be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air. In some cases, it could be 100 times more polluted. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. I have a strange little problem in my neck of the woods, and that is that everybody likes to burn their garden trash and other trash too. Lots of trash burning going on in my neighborhood. Not great. Air Doctor has really, really helped. I just fire it up on days when I can tell everybody's lighting their trash fires, and it keeps the household air clean. Air Doctor is the air purifier that has captured the attention of established media outlets like CNN, Money, ABC, and more. Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold, so your lungs don't have to. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund minus shipping. Head to airdoctorpro.com and use the promo code DRILLED to get up to 39% off or up to $300 off, depending on the model. Lock this special offer in by going to airdoctorpro.com and use the promo code DRILLED. This holiday season, get a gift for yourself too, and keep it simple. I gave myself the gift of a better, more convenient laundry experience. I know, laundry doesn't sound like a gift, but honestly, EarthBreeze just makes it so much easier. Think about how you actually do laundry. You have to work out how much detergent to pour, lift that big plastic jug, hope the goo doesn't get everywhere. It's annoying. But EarthBreeze Eco Sheets look like nothing I've ever seen in the detergent aisle. It's like a dryer sheet kind of, but it's the detergent and you throw it in and then that's it. There's no measuring, no nothing. It works in hot and cold. It's also dermatologist tested, hypoallergenic, and free of bleach and dyes. And it fights everyday stains and odors. You get a powerful clean, but you don't have to deal with all that packaging. Right now, my listeners can get started with EarthBreeze and save 40%, 40%. Go to earthbreeze.com/drilled. That's earthbreeze.com/drilled for 40% off your subscription. earthbreeze.com/drilled.
Okay, what do you call a neighborhood where everyone's a writer?
Brooklyn.
That's actually good. I'll accept it. But the answer we were looking for is a writer's block.
Oh, God. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Mm-hmm.
That's a good one.
What dinosaur is a writer's best friend?
Rhinoceros.
Mm-mm.
Try. Mm-mm. Oh, God. Amy, help.
It's not a real dinosaur.
I have no idea. I don't know.
Oh, my God. This is so easy.
I want to say T-Rex in some capacity.
It starts with a T. It's a thesaurus.
Oh, that
seriously,
is
seriously. That was so easy. Yeah, I don't know if you're going to get one.
No, I have two. I was going to say I have two thesaurus tabs open.
See? See? You were looking at your best friend in the face. So another cost of climate change that Americans are often, you know, insulated from is the toll on environmental activists all over the world. This is probably true for like the whole global North or the whole West, really, because we have all of these, you know, celebrated, wonderful environmental activists here and we love them, but we don't really get exposed a lot to how difficult it is to be an environmental activist below the equator, because I don't know all the reasons for why that is, but I have some guesses. But you've done a lot of reporting on this, right?
Yeah, for indigenous protesters in the Amazon, in Australia, in New Zealand, in the Philippines, and just the global South.
Wait, it's dangerous in New Zealand too?
It's funny because I think I saw this tweet about, you know, people thinking that New Zealand is perfect, but I think there are some, you know, indigenous affairs that aren't being recognized yet. Mm.
Oh, people definitely think it's like the new Canada. Everybody thinks it's perfect.
Yeah. I think the thing about indigenous communities too is that they're so connected to the land that I don't even think that climate migration is part of the picture or the solution. I don't know. The two of you have thoughts on that.
Yeah, I saw an article today about an environmental activist in South Africa who was shot dead in her home. She was 65 years old and was just courageously protesting this coal mine that was near her home, and these men just like entered her house at 6:30 p.m. and a 13-year-old child saw her shot dead. And it's just like so craven and brazen as that. And it's something that like, it's a story that I would have to go looking for. If I didn't follow African climate activists on Twitter, I probably wouldn't know that this happened. I've also seen plenty of stories of, I believe the Philippines is where the most environmental activists are under attack. It's terrifying. And yeah, so I wanted to ask you to read from a piece that you did again, yet another one, called For Indigenous Protesters, Defending the Environment Can Be Fatal.
According to a new report, they are not unusual. As police crack down on protests demanding justice and equity in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd in the U.S., it's clear that activism in general comes at a heavy price. Environmental activists specifically, particularly indigenous activists and activists of color, have for years faced high rates of criminalization, physical violence, and even murder for their efforts to protect the planet, according to a comprehensive analysis by researchers. I can't say that. The researchers analyzed nearly 2,800 social conflicts related to the environment using the Environmental Justice Atlas database, which they created in 2011 to monitor environmental conflicts around the world. The study published in the journal Global Environmental Change found that 20% of environmental defenders faced criminal charges or were imprisoned. 18% were victims of physical violence, and 13% were killed between 2011 and 2019. The likelihood of these consequences increased significantly for indigenous environmental defenders. 27% faced criminalization, 25% were victims of physical violence, and 19% were murdered.
Good grief.
Yeah, I just got chills reading that again.
Even wow. Yeah.
Wow.
19% were murdered? That's just unbelievable. I mean, it's wow.
And it's going up.
Very troubling.
Like, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's charting upward. And so I think about this as, you know, I guess, I don't know, people call me a climate activist. I think I'm a writer, but I guess I occupy a weird space in between where, like, I'm not necessarily afraid for my life at this level. I mean, we'll see what happens next week. But yeah, that's a certain amount of privilege that I try to be aware of.
It's also scary. You know, I'm a Filipina, so I sort of, you know from account of sort of the political landscape and climate in the Philippines. Of, I'm sure you've heard of the extrajudicial killings, the war on drugs with President Duterte in the Philippines, and that some of his, you know, personal attacks have been not only towards journalists, but also environmental activists who disagree with the president himself. And sort of justification of you know, eliminating drugs and declaring war on drugs is to kind of cause this unjust killings in the Philippines. And I guess, you know, a part of that, there's a lot of, and I think that feeds into why Philippines is so high in that, you know, as the deadliest country for environmental defenders. I mean, they've been labeled by the president himself as quote unquote the enemy of the state, you know, like social media by a bunch of propaganda. So
yeah, this is kind of like the same playbook as Jair Bolsonaro, and whoever that woman was who replaced Eva Morales for that brief period.
Wasn't it Janina Añez?
Yeah. Yeah. They all like immediately declare war on the indigenous folks. And I'm obsessed with this other podcast called Behind the Bastards. And they recently did an episode on the School of the Americas, which I'd heard of, but didn't know nearly enough about. And one of the things I found that was interesting was that they took people, you know, from fairly modest means and trained them as soldiers, so to speak, more like death squads, and turned them very strongly against indigenous people in their country and said, like, they are the reason your country, you know, why you don't have fancy washing machines or things like that back home. And, you know, this is like starting in the 50s, like most people didn't have washing machines. And so, yeah, and the way that that just like gets to build and progress over generations, and then it turns into like they, when these right-wing militia coups happen, that's immediately who they go after, because those are the people standing in the way of progress and development, which is really just another word for extraction and devastation.
Yeah. It's dark. It's real dark.
It's real dark, yeah.
We also wanted to talk about this, and you kind of mentioned this a little bit before, Mary, that, like, you know, sometimes people forget that Australia and New Zealand are in the global south,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, they're, like, as far south as you can kind of get.
Yeah. And that, you know, and yet, you know, I think those countries get more coverage than other, like, browner countries in the global south. I know. Yeah. Exactly. What is the difference? Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, but even still, you know, in as sort of these fires were barreling down on Sydney, people in the U.S. were kind of like, you know. I mean, there was way more coverage in the media, but
right,
it still seemed like there was a general sort of apathy.
And at the exact same time, Indonesia was going through these really horrible floods, which were, you know, another reason why they're moving their capital. But we weren't hearing about those floods nearly as much as we were hearing about the fires in Australia. And at the same time, we weren't hearing nearly enough about that, because if I talked to anybody outside of a climate circle, they were like, oh, those fires are still going on? Huh, I forgot. And so I picked out this piece from, and also the wild thing is that was this year. Those fires in Australia were this year. They were like December into February. They went on for a long time. And so I picked out this piece from David Wallace Wells last year. It was like December-ish. That reads really creepy to me now. And I'm going to read like a fairly long excerpt, so bear with me. It's called Global Apathy Toward the Fires in Australia is a Scary Portent for the Future. But the response to what's transpired in Australia, again, over a period that has stretched into months, is unfamiliar, to me at least, and not in a good way. Those California fires transfixed the world's attention. But while the ones still burning uncontrolled in Australia have gotten some media attention outside the country, in general, they have been treated as a scary but not apocalyptic local news story. There are all the usual factors, the desire to look away, to avoid contemplating the scariest aspects of contemporary life or what they portend for our future, the short-sightedness of the media, reluctant to cover climate disasters, at least as climate disasters, and the forces of denial. But two additional explanations suggest themselves to me, neither at all encouraging. The first is the duration of this climate horror has allowed us to normalize it even while it continues to unfold, continues to torture and brutalize and terrify. The campfire in Paradise, California did almost all of its damage in just 4 hours, and the short duration may have been as important to our collective horror as the speed. Perhaps, if it had lasted longer, even burning with equal ferocity, we would nevertheless simply have gotten used to it as the white noise catastrophe all around us, as impossible as that may seem to imagine, given the scale of suffering involved. The second explanation is perhaps even more distressing. If you had told me even 6 months ago that a climate disaster like this one would strike a place like Australia, I probably would not have expected global wall-to-wall media coverage, but I would have expected a lot more than this. That's not because of high-minded faith in the media or public interest in harrowing stories like these. It's for a more sinister reason. For decades now, the U.S. and Western Europe, we have paid much more attention to even small-scale suffering by the force of natural disaster when it strikes parts of the wealthy West than we ever muster for those suffering already so dramatically from climate change in Asia, and especially in the global South. So,
interesting.
There's a few reasons this is creepy to me, and the biggest one is that, well, the Australia-type fire struck California this year, and we kind of reacted the exact same way.
Yeah. I cannot tell you how many conversations I've had with people that are like, so what's up with these fires? Are they still going? I don't know. I haven't kept track.
Because it's hard to keep track, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me even in the state. Unless it's like, unless I'm in imminent danger from it, there's so much other shit going on that like, I'm like, you know, I stick my head out my door and if I smell smoke, then I check the fire report. And if I don't, honestly, I kind of like avoid it.
Yeah.
Which is terrible, but true. Yeah.
It's a way to keep your sanity. So are the fires still going? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I know they're rolling through Colorado right now.
Oh, Colorado's just like really, really in it right now. And then, I mean, honestly, actually what happened this week in California fire news is that, well, the entire West Coast had crazy wind happening. So some of the fires that had been contained got whipped up again a little bit. And then it seems like some of the preventative measures have worked, but that's also totally bonkers crazy. It's like 100,000 people were evacuated from the Bay Area preemptively, and about 1 million people had power cut for 2 days. Mm. Because it's like, we know this wind is coming, you know, we have to try to like mitigate all the risk factors. And it seems to have done, you know, have helped a bit, but like, it's just nuts that that's what it's going to take now.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Anyway, is your sister in Oregon too, Rachel, or where is she at?
She goes to UC Berkeley. So
okay, so she's right in there. Yeah. So did she get evacuated from Berkeley, or was she, did she stay?
No, she stayed, but she sent me a photo yesterday of this tree next to her apartment that fell.
Oh,
I was like, what happened?
Yeah. It was crazy. Not to get off on a whole California fire tangent, but yes, I agree. It's crazy. Yeah.
We're not talking about it enough, so you should never apologize for talking about it, Amy.
Yeah.
And I wonder, like, if, you know, this thing to relate, it may relate to that notion of, like, hurricane fatigue. It's sort of like, you know, aren't we, like, in Tropical Storm Zeta right now? And it's like,
yeah,
another tropical storm.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. No, it's we're getting numb, and it's not good. It's not good at all. And honestly, we're not even talking about the numbness nearly as much. And you know, we've just gotten, I didn't expect it to happen this fast. And I know, like, I've said this before, but it just seems like we just like are hop, skipping, and jumping through the climate projections, right? Like, I remember the summer before Australia was on fire, there was this really bad heat wave. And I remember watching the news and it was like freezing cold. It was like the polar vortex here in New York. And then seeing the images from Australia of like koalas crawling into people's swimming pools and, you know, like,
so bad.
I know, right? But then also like snakes getting into toilets, which is way less cute. And just like the road was melting because it was so hot. And I remember in the moment thinking like, oh my God, this is so terrible. This is so terrible. This is the worst thing I've ever seen. And then the very next year, it's on fire. Like the whole continent is on fire. And looking back at the heat wave and being like, I didn't recognize how good that was.
I feel like that does get into this whole, like, you know, we were just talking about the hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, are we going to get into like double Greek letters soon? It's crazy.
Is that a thing?
Oh yeah. What's next?
I don't know. I don't think we've ever gotten there.
I saw someone on Twitter suggested we should start naming them after oil companies like Tropical Storm Exxon and Chevron and ConocoPhillips. And you know what? I am here for it. Bring it on, like Hurricane Texaco. Yeah. You deserve it.
Totally. Totally. Yes.
But no, yeah, there's been like really low coverage of this year's hurricane season, like even more so than the fire season.
Totally.
Which
there's,
I feel like,
even less.
Feel like there, we had to have like a big outcry to make people cover, to make West East Coast papers cover the West Coast fires. But when it comes to the hurricanes, people have just been like, you know what? Fuck it. We're not going to talk about them. Like, we got an election. We got a pandemic. Nobody's going to talk about the hurricanes, right? Like, Sally was a crazy storm, which just like ramped up super fast. People didn't have time to run. And like, I could find any coverage of that.
No, because it came right after like a massive coverage of Hurricane Laura. And so, I don't know. I felt like, yeah, I guess that feeds in part of hurricane fatigue and that, like, oh, we're just covering another hurricane. And
yeah.
It's the same sort of path.
Right.
I don't know.
Ugh, right.
And that massive leap in names, right? Like, we went from Laura to Sally. Sally was on the heels of Laura. How many letters are in between there?
That's crazy. That's crazy. Yeah.
Right? And we don't even realize that that's happened until you, like, think about it for a second. So, yeah, there's... it's your turn to read, Amy. From this essay in Day Magazine called The Price of Normalizing Climate Disasters.
By Heather McTiertoney, who's great.
Yeah. And a Mississippian.
Climate disasters are happening more frequently but are getting less top-of-the-hour urgent coverage from news and media sources. And it's no wonder. Between the daily shock of another Trump administration scandal, racial injustice, and coronavirus pandemic updates, there's scarcely any room for climate incidents of any kind. Disaster philanthropy has shifted in how it addresses major weather events, yet the need for immediate assistance has not. What's even scarier is that many of the same regions are being hit repeatedly, thereby supporting conservatives' case for quote-unquote sacrifice zones across the country. Have we developed a sense of normalcy around these unnatural disasters? Climate complacency is real. So how do we shift this climate complacency? In an era when we see climate disasters increase day after day, year after year, what will it take for us to get the message that we neither have the time, energy, or space to be complacent about these issues? Like any good 12-step program, I believe the first step is recognizing that we have a problem. Climate change is happening, and being complacent is tantamount to intentionally ignoring the elephant in the room. Yeah, it's hard, though, because how do we shift that complacency or that numbness? Like, it's, I'm like, you know, even people like us who are very aware of all these things and know all the drivers and the intersections and things, like, you know, we feel numb sometimes. So it's just, it's a lot all at once. I don't know how to get out of that feeling.
Yeah. I don't know. How do you cope, Rachel?
I don't know. I guess I've been binge watching, but then it's also like rewatching shows because I know the ending, but I don't know.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that is a big part of it right now, right? Is just it's so much unknown all at once.
Oh my God. Yeah. I think you're so right. I've been doing that, and I don't think I even realize that's why I'm like watching The Office over and over and over and over.
Because, yeah. There's a comfort to knowing what happens, and I think that's something that, you know, makes you forget that you're in a pandemic, in the middle of a climate crisis, you're in the middle of, I don't know, what else.
Right.
Yeah. I think I kind of limit how many stories I'm following, honestly, like, so that I can stay present in climate. And it's also, like, I try to keep myself centered by focusing not on like what's going to happen in the world around me, but more on who I want to be, because that shouldn't change depending on what happens in the world around me, and trying to get like really clear about how I want to operate in the world and show up in the world, no matter who gets elected. Like, do I want to be someone who's reducing human suffering, adding to it, ignoring it? Like, who do I want to be? And just get super clear about that and stick to it. And let that be my compass, and then come what may.
So empowering, and just.
I mean, there are definitely still days where I slip down that slide of despair, though. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like what we've talked through here is like all of the different things that are on the ballot and on the line in this election. And this is mm-hmm. our last show before the election.
We're going to be back here. We're going to be back here, like, processing that shit.
Yeah, we're going to be back here on November 4th because that is my birthday and I'm going to need to talk to somebody while I eat a whole cake by myself.
And drink a bottle.
Yeah. A bottle of whiskey. Why should you never date an apostrophe?
Because it separates people.
What else does it do?
Causes contractions?
Nope. You guys are not.
Mom, that was good. That was good.
No, they're too possessive.
Oh, that's good. That's really good.
I was trying to give you hints. I feel like I would be remiss if I let us wrap up this recording without talking about, like, what are the last things you would want to say with a platform before this election?
Okay, for me, it's vote in your local shit. That is so important. Yes, vote for the president, but, like, the state and down ballot stuff is also really, really, really important right now. Mm-hmm. And it's worth, you know, dealing with a line or the post office or whatever you got to do it.
Yeah.
And also, I would also like to say, stop letting Democrats away with their fucking bullshit. Like, I'm so pissed off at how much they just rolled over on this Amy Coney Barrett thing. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, well, we can't be rude, you know? Come on.
Yeah. What makes you think this is the time for civility?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There was a really great article that came out. I think someone wrote it on Medium, and it was sort of like, you know, Americans need to stop waiting for someone to come up and punch them in the face to realize that they're in, like, a revolution here.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. They're not going to declare it. Up.
Exactly. It's like your rights are being whittled away bit by bit. Kind of like, you know, wake up and fucking do something.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Rachel?
I don't know. I just wanted to add to something that Amy said that, you know, I just wish that the culture of accountability, that momentum won't die. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in 2020, we've sort of fostered that, that culture of accountability at the height of the Black Lives Matter movement and just holding people in power accountable for their actions. And I just wish that, you know, that won't die anytime soon, even after the elections. But, and, you know, kind of, I guess my last words would be to the same sentiment of voting, is that even though I have the privilege of voting, even though I was born and raised in a U.S. territory with, you know, as a U.S. citizen, but lacking constitutional rights, and I feel like when you go out to vote, I feel like you should keep, you know, I want you to keep in mind the 4 million people, the 4 million Americans who are, you know, U.S. citizens who can serve in the military but can't vote. And, you know, that's something that I really care about, and that's something that needs to be highlighted more.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And on that vein, like, I say, remember all the people who don't get to vote on this election, but whose fate hangs in the balance. And in that, I'm including, you know, prisoners who don't get to vote. I'm including refugees on our borders. I'm including, like, really everybody in the world, because I wrote about this week. There is no meaningful path to climate justice without the United States doing a huge part of reducing its emissions and the emissions of the rest of the world, because we've stolen a lot of wealth, and that wealth is now needed to decarbonize the whole world. And so if we're going to have a compassionate climate future, the United States needs to be doing a lot of that work, logically and morally. So think about all of those people who don't get to vote. And don't worry about what Joe Biden says he's going to do. Worry about what we're going to make him do. So all of this talk about, like, I'm not voting for him because he's not going to ban fracking. Amy, just one more time, remind us why that's.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, the feds don't ban fracking. The states do. So, like,
there's that.
But also, if he pulls subsidies from fracking.
Which he said he's going to do.
Pull subsidies from all oil and gas companies. That will essentially kill fracking. And also, there's a whole bunch of other, you know, get rid of the Clean Water Act exemption for fracking. That will also kill fracking. Get rid of all of the clean air exemptions for fracking. That will also go a long way. And then, you know, yes, like, I think, you know, encourage states to ban permits for new fracking pipelines. But, like, I honestly, the fracking thing kind of bums me out because I feel like people don't understand the issue on either side, and, like, both sides get really angry and like aggro about it. And yeah, there's like a very clear path forward to deal with all the damage that fracking has done. And it doesn't need to be in the form of Biden saying, I'm going to have a national ban on fracking, which doesn't even make sense with how our laws
work. Right. It's also like,
sorry.
I'm not crunk about Joe Biden. I'm crunk about us. I'm crunk about what we can push for, right? Like, I'm excited. I believe that the momentum is on our side, and we just need, like, Joe Biden is a president that we can work with.
He is very easily influenced, so that's good for us.
Right. Whereas Donald Trump represents straight up authoritarianism, right? Like, these are not like, oh, he's not going to ban, he's not promising to ban fracking, so I'm not going to vote for him. Like, I don't need a promise. I just need a dare.
you know what I mean? Exactly.
So, and also, like, we were never in this for perfect. And climate people ought to know that better than anybody else, because we lost a grasp of a perfect world a very long time ago. So, I've never seen a perfect world. None of us ever will. So this isn't about perfect. This is about a chance in hell. And if we don't go after that, then I don't know what we thought we were doing here.
Yeah, totally. Thanks, Rachel, for making the time.
Thank you.
Have a good rest of your night. Thank you so much to Rachel for joining us on the show today. You can and should follow her on Twitter at Rach Ju Ramirez. That's RachJuRamirez. And follow her reporting over at Grist and sign up for her newsletter, The Breaking Point.
Right. And you can follow us on Twitter at Real Hot Take. I'm at Mary Hegler, and Amy is at Amy Westervelt.
That's right. And like we said earlier, you should subscribe to our newsletter. We're doing great stuff over there. Everything from movie reviews and podcast reviews to original reporting, climate grief essays, previews of essays we're publishing elsewhere. We've got a bunch of stuff there.
Yeah, including this week, I published an essay with the New Republic, which was just an adaptation of a shorter thing that I had published in Hot Takes. So
yeah,
you could have been on the ground floor of that, people.
That's right. It's true. We have a premium version with all of those fun features for as little as $7 a month or $80 a year. Or if you really love us, you can go big and sign up for a founding membership at $210 and get yourself a free t-shirt.
And our undying loyalty.
Yes.
But we understand that everyone can't do that right now. And we believe firmly that the climate story should not live behind a paywall. So we produce a free newsletter too that has a roundup of weekly coverage from everywhere. And I'm talking like all over the interwebs. And a free feature from us and teasers for all of the good stuff in the premium newsletter. So you won't be all that left out.
That's right. Yeah, it's very handy kind of reading guide to the week's climate coverage, that digest. And we have merchandise now. We've got hats and shirts and mugs, and we're getting even more things. If you've gotten your shirts, or your hat or your mug, whatever, please send us pictures. We want to see what they're looking like, and we want to see that stuff out in the wild.
Yeah. All right, that's it for this episode. If you've got questions about the general theme, please send them to hottakes@criticalfrequency.org. That's hottakes, plural, @criticalfrequency.org.
That's right. And make sure to leave us a rating or review in Apple Podcasts. If you have a negative review, you can send those to Brian Kahn. He's our hate mail expert. Mm-hmm. Brian.Kahn, that's K-A-H-N, @earther.com.
Yep, make sure to do that. All right, we will talk to y'all later.